Chapter 8, A Battle to Fight. The Enemy. Enemy-occupied territory. That is what this world is. C.S. Lewis. We are but warriors for the working day. Our gayness and our guilt are all besmirched, with rainy marching in the painful field. But, by the mass, our hearts are in the trim. Henry V. If we would endeavor, like men of courage, to stand in the battle, surely we would feel the favorable assistance of God from heaven. For he who giveth us occasion to fight, to the end we may get the victory, is ready to succor those that fight manfully and do trust in his grace. Thomas A. Kempis. Dad, are there castles anymore? Luke and I were sitting at the breakfast table. Actually, he was seated, and I was attending His Royal Highness, making him toast with apricot jam. As soon as he asked the question, I knew what his young heart was wondering. Are there any great adventures anymore? Are there any great battles? I wanted to explain that indeed there are, but before I could reply, he got this gleam in his eye and asked, "And are there any dragons?" Oh, how deeply this is written into the masculine soul. The boy is a warrior. The boy is his name. A man needs a battle to fight. He needs a place for the warrior in him to come alive and be honed, trained, seasoned. If Bly is right, and I believe he is, that the early death of a man's warriors keeps the boy in him from growing up, then the opposite is true. If we can reawaken the fierce quality in a man, hook it up to a higher purpose, release the warrior within, then the boy can grow up and become truly masculine. As I was working on this book a few days ago, Blaine came downstairs and without a word slipped the drawing he had made in front of me. It is a pencil sketch of an angel with broad shoulders and long hair. His wings are sweeping around him as if just unfurled to reveal that he is holding a large, two-handed sword like a Scottish claymore. He holds the blade upright, ready for action. His gaze is steady and fierce. Beneath the drawing are the words, written in the hand of a 9-year-old. Every man is a warrior inside, but the choice to fight is his own. And a little child shall lead them. Blaine knows as deeply as he knows anything that every man is a warrior, yet every man must choose to fight. The warrior is not the only role a man must play. There are others we will explore later. But the warrior is crucial in our movement toward any masculine integrity. It is hardwired into every man. I have in my files a copy of a letter written by Major Sullivan Ballou, a Union officer in the 2nd Rhode Island. He speaks to his wife on the eve of the Battle of Bull Run, a battle he senses will be his last. He speaks tenderly to her of his undying love, of the memories of blissful moments I have spent with you. Ballou mourns the thought that he must give up the hope of future years when, God willing, we might still have lived and loved together and seen our sons grow up to honorable manhood around us. Yet, in spite of his love, the battle calls, and he cannot turn from it. I have no misgivings about or lack of confidence in the cause in which I am engaged, and my courage does not halt or falter. How great a debt we owe to those who went before us through the blood and sufferings of the Revolution. Sarah, my love for you is deathless. It seems to bind me with mighty cables that nothing but omnipotence could break. And yet, a greater cause comes over me like a strong wind and bears me unresistibly on with all these chains to the battlefield. A man must have a battle to fight, a great mission to his life that involves and yet transcends even home and family. He must have a cause to which he is devoted, even unto death, for this is written into the fabric of his being. Listen carefully now. You do. That is why God created you, to be his intimate ally, to join him in the great battle. You have a specific place in the line, a mission God made for you. That is why it is so essential to hear from God about your true name, because in that name is the mission of your life. Churchill was called upon to lead the British through the desperate hours of World War II. He said, "I felt as if I were walking with destiny, and that all my past life had been but a preparation for this hour and for this trial." The same is true for you. Your whole life has been preparation. I'd love to be William Wallace, leading the charge with a big sword in my hand, sighed a friend. But I feel like I'm the guy back there in the 4th row, with a hoe. That's a lie of the enemy, that your place is really insignificant, that you aren't really armed for it anyway. In your life, you are William Wallace. Who else could be? There is no other man who can replace you in your life, in the arena you've been called to. If you leave your place in the line, it will remain empty. No one else can be who you are meant to be. You are the hero in your story. Not a bit player, not an extra, but the main man. This is the next leg in the initiation journey, when God calls a man forward to the front lines. He wants to develop and release in us the qualities every warrior needs, including a keen awareness of the enemies we will face. Above all else, a warrior has a vision. He has a transcendence to his life, a cause greater than self-preservation. The root of all our woes and our false self was this. We were seeking to save our life, and we lost it. Christ calls a man beyond that. But whoever loses his life for me and for the gospel will save it. Mark 8:35. Again, this isn't just about being willing to die for Christ. It's much more daily than that. For years, all my daily energy was spent trying to beat the trials in life and arrange for a little pleasure. My weeks were wasted away either striving or indulging. I was a mercenary. A mercenary fights for pay, for his own benefit. His life is devoted to himself. The quality of a true warrior, says Bly, is that he is in service to a purpose greater than himself, that is, to a transcendent cause. That is the moving quality in Ballou's letter. That is the secret of the warrior heart of Jesus. Second, a warrior is cunning. He knows when to fight and when to run. He can sense a trap and never charges blindly ahead. He knows what weapons to carry and how to use them. Whatever specific terrain you are called to, at home, at work, in the realm of the arts or industry or world politics, you will always encounter three enemies: the world, the flesh, and the devil. They make up sort of an unholy trinity. Because they always conspire together, it's a bit difficult to talk about them individually. In any battle, at least two of them are involved, but usually it's all three. Still, they each have their own personality, so I'll take them one at a time and then try to show how they collude against us. Let's start with the enemy closest at hand, the traitor within. John Owen says, in Sin and Temptation, "However strong a castle may be, if a treacherous party resides inside, ready to betray at the first opportunity possible, the castle cannot be kept safe from the enemy. Traitors occupy our own hearts, ready to side with every temptation and to surrender to them all." Ever since that fateful day when Adam gave away the essence of his strength, men have struggled with a part of themselves that is ready at the drop of a hat to do the same. We don't want to speak up unless we know it will go well, and we don't want to move unless we're guaranteed success. What the scriptures call the flesh, the old man, or the sinful nature, is that part of fallen Adam in every man that always wants the easiest way out. It's much easier to masturbate than to make love to your wife, especially if things are not well between you and initiating sex with her feels risky. It's much easier to go down to the driving range and attack a bucket of balls than it is to face the people at work who are angry at you. It's much easier to clean the garage, organize your files, cut the grass, or work on the car than it is to talk to your teenage daughter. To put it bluntly, your flesh is a weasel, a poser, and a selfish pig. And your flesh is not you. Did you know that? Your flesh is not the real you. When Paul gives us his famous passage on what it's like to struggle with sin in Romans 7, he tells a story we are all too familiar with. "I decide to do good, but I don't really do it. I decide not to do bad, but then I do it anyway. My decisions, such as they are, don't result in actions. Something has gone wrong deep within me and gets the better of me every time. It happens so regularly that it's predictable. The moment I decide to do good, sin is there to trip me up. I truly delight in God's commands, but it's pretty obvious that not all of me joins in that delight. Parts of me covertly rebel, and just when I least expect it, they take charge." Okay, we've all been there many times, but what Paul concludes is just astounding. "I am not really the one doing it. The sin within me is doing it." Romans 7:20. Did you notice the distinction he makes? Paul says, "Hey, I know I struggle with sin, but I also know that my sin is not me. This is not my true heart. You are not your sin. Sin is no longer the truest thing about the man who has come into union with Jesus. Your heart is good. I will give you a new heart and put a new spirit in you. Ezekiel 36:26. The big lie in the church today is that you are nothing more than a sinner saved by grace. You are a lot more than that. You are a new creation in Christ. The New Testament calls you a saint, a holy one, a son of God. In the core of your being, you are a good man. Yes, there is a war within us, but it is a civil war. The battle is not between us and God. No, there is a traitor within who wars against our true heart, fighting alongside the Spirit of God in us. A new power is in operation. The Spirit of life in Christ, like a strong wind, has magnificently cleared the air, freeing you from a fated lifetime of brutal tyranny at the hands of sin and death. Anyone, of course, who has not welcomed this invisible but clearly present God, the Spirit of Christ, won't know what we're talking about. But for you who welcomed Him, in whom He dwells, if the alive and present God who raised Jesus from the dead moves into your life, He'll do the same thing in you that He did in Jesus. When God lives and breathes in you, and He does, as surely as He did in Jesus, you are delivered from that dead life. Romans 8:2-3 and 9-11. The real you is on the side of God against the false self. Knowing this makes all the difference in the world. The man who wants to live valiantly will lose heart quickly if he believes that his heart is nothing but sin. Why fight? The battle feels lost before it even begins. No, your flesh is your false self, the poser, manifest in cowardice and self-preservation, and the only way to deal with it is to crucify it. Now, follow me very closely here. We are never, ever told to crucify our heart. We are never told to kill the true man within us, never told to get rid of those deep desires for battle and adventure and beauty. We are told to shoot the traitor. How? Choose against him every time you see him raise his ugly head. Walk right into those situations you normally run from. Speak right to the issues you normally remain silent over. If you want to grow in true masculine strength, then you must stop sabotaging yours. Sabotage. Rich is a deeply passionate young man who is really trying to learn what it means to be a man. A few weeks ago, he had plans to go out with some friends. They promised to call him before they left and then come pick him up. They never called. A few days later, when one of them brought it up, Rich said, "Oh, that's okay, it's no big deal." But inside, he was furious. That is sabotage. He deliberately chose to push his true strength down and live the false self. Do that enough, and you won't believe you have any strength. I've noticed when I deny the anger I'm feeling, it turns into fear. If we will not allow what Sam Keen calls fire in the belly, something weaker will take its place. I had a chance a few years back to tell my boss what I really thought of him. Not in sinful anger, there's a difference. Not to hurt him, but to help him. He actually asked me to, called to see if I was free to chat for a moment. I knew what he was calling for, and I ran. I told him I was busy. For days afterward, I felt weak. I felt like a poser. I sabotaged my strength by refusing it. Sabotage also happens when we give our strength away. Taking a bribe, letting yourself be bought off, accepting flattery in exchange for some sort of loyalty is sabotage. Refusing to confront an issue, because if you keep quiet, you'll get a promotion or be made an elder or keep your job, corrupts you down deep. Masturbation is sabotage. It is an inherently selfish act that tears you down. I've spoken with many men whose addiction to masturbation has eroded their sense of strength. So does sexual involvement with a woman you're not married to. Carl is another young man whom the ladies seem to find especially attractive. I am astounded what young women will offer when they are famished for the love and affirmation they have never had from their fathers. They will throw themselves at a man to get a taste of being wanted, desired. Carl came to me because his sexual activity was out of control. Dozens upon dozens of women offered themselves to him, and each time he gave in, he felt weakened. His resolve to resist was less the next time around. Things began to change for Carl when he saw the whole sexual struggle, not so much as sin, but as a battle for his strength. He wants to be strong, wants it desperately, and that began to fuel his choice to resist. As Akempis said, A man must strive long and mightily within himself before he can learn fully to master himself. Carl and I spent hours praying through every one of those relationships, confessing the sin, breaking the bonds sexual liaisons form between two souls, cleansing his strength, asking God to restore him. He did, and I'm grateful to say that those days are over for Carl. It wasn't easy, but it was real. He is happily married now. The real thing. Start choosing to live out of your strength, and you'll discover that it grows each time. Rich was after some brakes for his car. He called the parts store, and they quoted him a price of $50 for the pair. But when he got down there, the guy told him it would be $90. He was taking Rich for a fool, and something in Rich was provoked. Normally, he would have said, "Oh, that's okay, it's no big deal," and paid the higher price. But not this time. He told the guy that the price was $50 and stood his ground. The guy backed down and stopped trying to rip him off. "It felt great," Rich told me later. "I felt that I was finally acting like a man." Now, that may seem like a simple story, but this is where you will discover your strength in the daily details of your life. Begin to taste your true strength, and you'll want more. Something in the center of your chest feels weighty, substantial. We must let our strength show up. It seems so strange, after all this, that a man would not allow his strength to arrive. But many of us are unnerved by our own masculinity. What will happen if we really let it out? In Healing the Masculine Soul, Gordon Dalby tells a remarkable story about a man who was plagued by a recurring dream, a nightmare in which a ferocious lion kept chasing the man until he dropped exhausted and awoke screaming. The man was dismayed. He did not know what the dream meant. Was the lion a symbol of fear? Something in his life overwhelming him? One day the man was guided by his pastor, a friend of Dalby's, to revisit the dream in prayer. As they prayed, the pastor on impulse invited the man to recall the dream, even in all its fear. Hesitantly, the man agreed, and soon reported that indeed, the lion was in sight and headed his way. The pastor then instructed the man, "When the lion comes close to you, try not to run away, but instead, stand there and ask him who or what he is and what he's doing in your life. Can you try that?" Shifting uneasily in his chair, the man agreed, then reported what was happening. "The lion is snorting and shaking his head, standing right there in front of me. I ask him who he is, and... oh, I can't believe what he's saying," he says. "I'm your courage and your strength. Why are you running away from me?" I had a recurring dream similar to this one for many years, especially in adolescence. A great wild stallion was standing on the ridge of a hill. I sensed danger, but not an evil danger, just something strong and valiant and greater than me. I tried to sneak away. The stallion always turned in time to see me and came charging down the hill. I would wake just as he was upon me. It seems crazy that a man would sneak away from his strength, fear it to show up, but that is why we sabotage. Our strength is wild and fierce, and we are more than unsettled by what may happen if we let it arrive. One thing we know, nothing will ever be the same. One client said to me, "I'm afraid I'll do something bad if I let all this show up." No, the opposite is true. You'll do something bad if you don't. Remember, a man's addictions are the result of his refusing his strength. Years ago, Brent gave me a piece of advice that changed my life. "Let people feel the weight of who you are," he said, "and let them deal with it." That brings us into the arena of our next enemy. The world. What is this enemy that the scripture calls the world? Is it drinking and dancing and smoking? Is it going to the movies or playing cards? That is a shallow and ridiculous approach to holiness. It numbs us to the fact that good and evil are much more serious. The scriptures never prohibit drinking alcohol, only drunkenness. Dancing was a vital part of King David's life. And while there are some very godly movies out there, there are also some very ungodly churches. No, the world is not a place or a set of behaviors. It is any system built by our collective sin, all our false selves coming together to reward and destroy each other. Take all those posers out there, put them together in an office or a club or a church, and what you get is what the scriptures mean by the world. The world is a carnival of counterfeits, counterfeit battles, counterfeit adventures, counterfeit beauties. Men should think of it as a corruption of their strength. "Battle your way to the top," says the world, "and you are a man." Why is it then that the men who get there are often the emptiest, most frightened, prideful posers around? They are mercenaries, battling only to build their own kingdoms. There is nothing transcendent about their lives. The same holds true of the adventure addicts. No matter how much you spend, no matter how far you take your hobby, it's still merely that, a hobby. And as for the counterfeit beauties, the world is constantly trying to tell us that the golden-haired woman is out there. Go for her. The world offers a man a false sense of power and a false sense of security. Be brutally honest now. Where does your own sense of power come from? Is it how pretty your wife is? Or your secretary? Is it how many people attend your church? Is it knowledge that you have an expertise and that makes others come to you, bow to you? Is it your position, degree, or title? A white coat, a PhD, a podium, or a paneled office can make a man feel like pretty neat stuff. What happens inside you when I suggest you give it up? Take a moment and consider what you would think of yourself if tomorrow you lost everything that the world has rewarded you for. Without Christ, a man must fail miserably, says MacDonald, or succeed even more miserably. Jesus warns us against anything that gives a false sense of power. When you walk into a company dinner or a church function, he said, take a back seat. Choose the path of humility. Don't be a self-promoter, a glad-hander, a poser. Climb down the ladder. Have the mail clerk over for dinner. Treat your secretary like she's more important than you. Look to be the servant of all. Where am I deriving my sense of strength and power from is a good question to ask yourself, often. If you want to know how the world really feels about you, just start living out of your true strength. Say what you think, stand up for the underdog, challenge foolish policies. They'll turn on you like sharks. Remember the film Jerry Maguire? Jerry is an agent for professional athletes who comes to a sort of personal epiphany about the corruption of his firm. He issues a memo, a vision statement, urging a more humane approach to their work. Let's stop treating people like cattle, he says. Stop serving the bottom line and really serve our clients. All his buddies cheer him on. When the firm dumps him, as he knew they would, they rush to seize his clients. I've seen this time and time again. A friend of mine confronted his pastor on some false statements the pastor had made to get his position. This shepherd of the flock started circulating rumors that my friend was gay. He tried to ruin his reputation. The world of posers is shaken by a real man. They'll do whatever it takes to get you back in line. Threaten you, bribe you, seduce you, undermine you. They crucified Jesus. But it didn't work, did it? You must let your strength show up. Remember Christ in the garden, the sheer force of his presence? Many of us have actually been afraid to let our strength show up because the world doesn't have a place for it. Fine, the world's screwed up. Let people feel the weight of who you are and let them deal with it. The devil. My wife and I were driving home the other day from an afternoon out and running a bit late to get to our son's last soccer game of the season. I was in the driver's seat and we were enjoying a lingering conversation about some dreams we have for the future. After several minutes, we realized that we were caught in a traffic jam that was going nowhere. Precious moments slipped by as tension mounted in the car. In an effort to be helpful, Stacy suggested an alternate route. If you take a right here and go up to First Street, we can cut over and take about 5 minutes off the drive. I was ready to divorce her. I'm serious. In about 20 seconds, I was ready for separation. If the judge had been in the car, I'd have signed the papers right there. Good grief. Over a comment about my driving? Is that all that was going on in that moment? I sat at the wheel, silent and steaming. On the outside, I looked cool. Inside, here is what was happening. Geez, doesn't she think I know how to get there? I hate it when she does that. Then another voice says, she always does that. And I say, internally, the whole dialogue took place internally, in the blink of an eye. Yeah, she does. She's always saying stuff like that. I hate that about her. A feeling of accusation and anger and self-righteousness sweeps over me. Then the voice says, John, this is never going to change. And I say, this is never going to change. And the voice says, you know, John, there are a lot of women out there who would be deeply grateful to have you as their man. And I think, yeah, there are a lot of women out there. You get the picture. Change the characters and the setting, and the very same thing has happened to you. only you probably thought the whole thing was your own mess. The devil, no doubt, has a place in our theology, but is he a category we even think about in the daily events of our lives? Has it ever crossed your mind that not every thought that crosses your mind comes from you? What I experienced in the midst of traffic that day happens all the time in marriages, in ministries, in any relationship. We are being lied to all the time. Yet we never stop to say, wait a minute, who else is speaking here? Where are those ideas coming from? Where are those feelings coming from? If you read the saints from every age before the modern era, that pride-filled age of reason, science, and technology we all were thoroughly educated in, you'll find that they take the devil very seriously indeed. As Paul says, we are not unaware of his schemes. But we, the enlightened, have a much more common sense approach to things. We look for a psychological or physical or even political explanation for every trouble we meet. Who caused the Chaldeans to steal Job's herds and kill his servants? Satan, clearly. Yet do we even give him a passing thought when we hear of terrorism today? Who kept that poor woman bent over for 18 years, the one Jesus healed on the Sabbath? Satan, clearly. But do we consider him when we are having a headache that keeps us from praying or reading Scripture? Who moved Ananias and Sapphira to lie to the apostles? Satan again. But do we really see his hand behind a fallout or schism in ministry? Who was behind that brutal assault on your own strength, those wounds you've taken? As William Gurnall said, it is the image of God reflected in you that so enrages hell. It is this at which the demons hurl their mightiest weapons. There is a whole lot more going on behind the scenes of our lives than most of us have been led to believe. Take Christmas, for example. Most of you probably have a nativity scene that you take out over the holidays and place on a mantle or coffee table. Most of these scenes share a regular cast of characters. Shepherds, wise men, maybe a few barnyard animals, Joseph, Mary, and of course, the baby Jesus. Yes, ours has an angel or two, and I imagine yours does as well. But that's about as far as the supernatural gets. What is the overall mood of the scene? Don't they all have sort of a warm, pastoral atmosphere to them, a quiet, intimate feel like the one you get when you sing Silent Night or Away in a Manger? And while that's all very true, it is also very deceiving because it is not the full picture of what's really going on. For that, you have to turn to Revelation 12. A great and wondrous sign appeared in heaven, a woman clothed with the sun, with the moon under her feet, and a crown of 12 stars on her head. She was pregnant and cried out in pain as she was about to give birth. Then another sign appeared in heaven, an enormous red dragon with 7 heads and 10 horns and 7 crowns on his heads. His tail swept a third of the stars out of the sky and flung them to earth. The dragon stood in front of the woman who was about to give birth so that he might devour her child the moment it was born. She gave birth to a son, a male child, who will rule all the nations with an iron scepter. And there was war in heaven. Michael and his angels fought against the dragon, and the dragon and his angels fought back. But he was not strong enough, and they lost their place in heaven. The great dragon was hurled down, that ancient serpent called the devil or Satan, who leads the whole world astray. He was hurled to earth, and his angels with him. As Philip Yancey says, I have never seen this version of the story on a Christmas card. Yet, it is the truer story, the rest of the picture of what is going on that fateful night. Yancey calls the birth of Christ the Great Invasion, a daring raid by the ruler of the forces of good into the universe's seat of evil. Spiritually speaking, this is no Silent Night. It is D-Day. It is almost beyond my comprehension, too, and yet I accept that this notion is the key to understanding Christmas and is, in fact, the touchstone of my faith. As a Christian, I believe that we live in parallel worlds. One world consists of hills and lakes and barns and politicians and shepherds watching their flocks by night. The other consists of angels and sinister forces and the whole spiritual realm. The child is born, the woman escapes, and the story continues like this. Then the dragon was enraged at the woman and went off to make war against the rest of her offspring, those who obey God's commandments and hold to the testimony of Jesus. Revelation 12:17. Behind the world and the flesh is an even more deadly enemy, one we rarely speak of and are even much less ready to resist. Yet, this is where we live now, on the front lines of a spiritual war that is to blame for most of the casualties you see around you and most of the assault against you. It's time we prepared ourselves for it. Yes, Luke, there is a dragon. Here is how you slay him.